You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 1st of February 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, the political circus across the US reaches feverish levels as the Iowa caucus gets underway. But for a state lacking in any great diversity, is the event's reputation a little too inflated? We'll also look at the historic session of Burma's new parliament as Aung San Suu Kyi caps off a struggle of more than 25 years in the making. Plus, the US efforts against the so-called Islamic State expand to include its allies in Afghanistan. And how did a Chinese Ponzi scheme snowball into a $59 billion disaster? That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are the journalist Samira Shackle and Raffaello Pantucci, Director of International Studies, or Security Studies indeed, at the Royal United Services Institute. Welcome both to the programme. The American state of Iowa really rates as the epicentre of world news, but in the midst of such an unlikely presidential race, the Hawkeye state is today swarming with the country's political elite, and many more hoping to snap a picture. The caucus vote in Iowa is the first of many more contests that will eventually decide who becomes the party nominee for president. Unsurprisingly, polls still suggest that Donald Trump will take the Republican nomination, with Hillary Clinton up for the Democratic ticket. But looking back at the last five Iowa caucuses, the event chose the eventual nominee just twice: Bob Dole in 1996 and George W. Bush in 2000. So it was all the media furore, a bit of a high on hot air. Samira, okay, we've run through it all. It's a complicated battle. So there's still many months to go, and we'll see what happens over these next few caucuses. It's just the first of many polls and tests that will decide who gets the vote. But what do we think of the two front runners? What do you think are their likelihoods of kind of taking the nominations?
I mean, that's the thing. It's a race that's been really defined by its unpredictability, and I think that's probably why there's even perhaps more than usual a tendency to cling on to the first vote as something that might give us some indication of how it's going to go, because it's been so difficult to predict so far. I mean, if you think just on the face of it, a sort of self-avowed socialist being actually quite in the running for the Democratic nomination, when socialist is pretty much a dirty word in American politics, you've got Donald Trump, who's just completely unconcerned with all normal rules sort of binding a political candidate, sort of openly misogynist and racist at points, and sort of not bothered at all about backing up policy. All of those things, these races are primaries are often very colourful, particularly I think through the eyes of the slightly more staid political system in the UK. But this is particularly unpredictable, and it's just really, really difficult to say. I mean, perhaps the voting over the next couple of weeks will give us some indication of where the land lies, but yeah.
Raffaello, as we were saying, the outcome, it's going to be intriguing. Two very different candidates pushing to the fore. Yeah. Iowa, we get very excited about the start of the kind of the gun being fired, as it were. But as we said, Iowa is not exactly representative of the whole of the US. It just happens to be one of those polls that comes first. But I guess it's all about momentum, isn't it? And that's what we're trying to see. Who has the wind behind them? Because even now, people they keep on thinking there's going to be some correction in the Republican race. That, is it just a joke that everyone's backing Donald Trump? Surely that's going to be Ted Cruz in the end. But it doesn't look like it at the moment. So is this just really about gauging where the momentum is?
I think that it is a lot in some ways. I mean, I think that in some ways, it feels like the starting piston on this election was starting a long time ago. We've been talking about it for months, if not going on a year now, with Donald Trump rising through the polls and Hillary Clinton, who's been waiting around to be president forever. So in many ways, it does feel a bit like that. I think in some ways, this is the first kind of the time when you actually, the rubber hits the road and, you really get a feel for what do the public actually think, not in some sort of, arbitrary poll, which a news organization does in response to some random event that seems to happen, but an actual sort of moment where people will make a decision, you know, and actually start to make a decision which points which kind of direction which they're going in. So one could argue that, you know, you could maybe see some bubbles being popped here. You know, I think some of the sort of candidates that you're seeing, particularly on the Republican side, you know, like Ben Carson or something, who sort of popped up a while ago and now seems to have faded, you know, one suspects if he does a really bad showing here and then it's followed up by a sort of a loss in New Hampshire that doesn't sort of put him amongst the first three, you know, his campaign's probably over at that point. So I think it's more a case of winnowing out some of those ones rather than necessarily this being the big moment where we're going to see, okay, you know, our next president's going to be so-and-so. I think what you'll start to see here is really, you know, picking off some of the candidates who've always been a bit sort of one wonders about. And this will kind of be the nail in their coffin to, you know, go back and think about it for another 4 years and then try again, I guess.
So let's just look at the two candidates who are in the lead at the moment. The Donald Trump phenomenon is very hard, as we've said in this.
Donald Trump. That's a nice thing to put there. You know, that's exactly right.
As we've said before, it's very complicated for Europeans in a way to get their heads around it. But what seems to be, he seems to be just touching into a very kind of, you know, a proper group of people who feel alienated from politics. Mm. And it was interesting hearing him make this, you know, another one of these speeches again yesterday about, you know, America is losing. It feels it's like losing against Islamic State. It's not winning in the business battle. It's not winning in global trade. And he touches on something that people are a little bit nervous of. I wonder if he is, you know, that America yearns for somebody more strident, more outspoken in a time when it is facing foes, when it's got, you know, Putin on one side, for example, or, you know, Islamic State, big, you know, I'm not comparing those two people, groups, by the way, but I mean, when you've got proper enemies at home, you don't want somebody who seems to be kind of an apologist or seems to be mild-mannered. You want somebody who you feel will fight your corner just as strongly.
I think that's probably true. And I think added to that, perhaps exacerbating that, is just the sort of dire economic situation that's been there, dysfunctional political system that's been sort of quite hampered by partisan tensions over the last 8 years, really, and also sort of stagnating wages, sort of stalled social mobility. All of those things, I think, add to a real sense of anger and disaffection, which you know, Donald Trump's offering quite an emotional response to. I mean, I think it's quite a powerful rallying cry for many of the people who are backing Trump most ardently. Are you know, sort of it's generally people who are sort of lower down the economic spectrum, lower down the educational spectrum as well. It's people who sort of feel a bit left behind by the current system. So external threats, yes, but I think also deep frustration with the way the system is. It's also interesting that one of the things people say is that Donald Trump's very rich, so he won't be in the pocket of the lobbyists, which is quite an interesting way of viewing it. And that it's, you know, it clearly speaks to a frustration with the dysfunctions of the Washington system.
But you see, that's such an artificial comparison, because I think of Berlusconi in Italy, who was also so rich that he wouldn't be in the hands of it. But that just meant that he was he cared about only his own interests.
Yeah, I don't think it's sensible at all, but it is something that comes up a lot.
And Rafaela, why do you think that Hillary Clinton, hasn't had the cut through, why hasn't she been the clear winner all the time? Yeah, you know, because everything should be on her side. You know, she has this amazing legacy. She was, she was extraordinary on foreign policy. You know, she kept a certain independence of mind from Obama. You know, she connected with women in a really interesting way. Yeah, she, as we said before, she's good with minorities, all sorts of things, but somehow just hasn't quite caught on with especially younger voters.
I mean, I think it's in some ways, I'd argue, it's probably the problem that she faced the first time when she ran, when she was against Barack Obama, which is this problem of there's a sense, I think, that she's just kind of expecting it. You know, and she's got to sit back and cruise. And I think no one likes to have someone who's just so certain and cocksure of themselves to just get that position as though it's some sort of birthright that they're just going to get handed to them. I don't think that appeals to voters. And I think that's a problem that she's really got. It's that sense of, you know, well, is she really fresh? I mean, you know, Americans, you know, historically are very Republican, right? I mean, there was the whole Boston Tea Party, and one could point to all sorts of things in history about rejecting the sort of kings of England. But, you know, I think it's fundamentally this sense of, you know, you don't want a leader who is this kind of entitled being who is just sort of expecting to get it and just needs to wait it out and then eventually they'll get it. I think that, you know, people kind of need to be excited by the person they're going to vote for. And I think on the Democratic side, you just haven't had any other candidates really step forwards. You know, I remember when Obama was first running and there was that question, well, could he really beat Clinton, you know, or is the sort of Clinton machine going to kind of clock through it. And, you know, he went for it and he pushed through and he did manage to cross that hurdle and then eventually win and become president. And I think part of the reason he was able to do that was this sense of, you know, Clintonian inevitability, which I think jarred against most voters.
I'd also add to that. I think that it's been an election campaign. So, I mean, the primaries so far have just been really fought on emotions, and she's maybe offering a pitch that she's sort of quite reasoned and an experienced stateswoman and so on, but she's not necessarily offering the appeal to raw emotion that someone like Trump is.
I think you make a really interesting point, because I think that part of her problem is that she is too experienced. Because what happens is she's up against Donald Trump, for example, who Donald Trump, you know, he's never had to be in power and make those compromises and do the boring kind of legwork. And, I'm sure he would be, you know, he would find his way through it. But what's interesting is she's had to make all, she knows that all those things like fighting IS, okay, it's not that simple. So when she comes, she goes on, you know, on the stump, she sounds more nuanced, but it doesn't cut through with the way like someone like Trump, who's just like, it's a bad thing, we will destroy it. Yeah. And that's you know, in a way, it's the simplicity of not having the long experience. Mm. Well, anyway, that's enough from me, because we're going to move on. We need to hear from our guest. A half century of military rule has finally culminated in a moment many Burmese people thought they might never see. Aung San Suu Kyi led her National League for Democracy Party into Parliament today, 26 years after her initial election win. The NLD took 80% of all electable positions during November's election, though the military reserved a quarter of the seats available. But while it often seems like the perfect end to decades of political turmoil, the military is still a very strong presence in Burmese life, and Aung San Suu Kyi has a very difficult road ahead. How do we think that this will play out, Samira, because, you know, as we said, again, it's one of those interesting stories, like the US election, the close vision, the distant vision. She seems a hero to everybody here in the West. Mm. Everybody's excited about her taking power, feels that she has, you know, history on her side. But again, on the ground, nitty gritty, dealing with the military, it's not going to be quite that simple, is it?
No, absolutely. And I think that sort of heroes and freedom fighters do often suffer a little bit in terms of their sort of public image through the necessary compromises and difficulties of being in power. Because, I mean, it's an incredible achievement after, you know, so many years of campaigning to have brought even a sort of semblance of democracy to Burma. But, you know, it's going to be really, really difficult series of compromises. Aung San Suu Kyi has already been criticised for not really saying much at all about the plight of the Rohingya Muslims, a sort of huge disenfranchised population. Arguably, there's arguments made that she can't say too much about it without alienating other sort of support bases and so on. There's the question of compromising with the military. She's asked her supporters to be humble, I think was the word she used, given that the army's got this tendency to intervene if they feel on the back foot. And so it's a really difficult line. Also the question of international alliances with China, for instance, which might end up sort of aggravating her long-time supporters in the West. So it's going to be a really, really difficult line to walk. And of course, it's a country that's ravaged with problems, very little modern infrastructure, huge social problems, ethnic tensions and so on. And that's a lot to take on for anyone.
So just before we move on, are you dismayed? Because it is an important point about her failure to kind of come to the aid of the Muslim minority, the Rohingya.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a real shame, but I think that's probably the first sign of something that's of a sort of great human rights and freedom campaigner being slightly tainted by power, I suppose, because I think that she's been such a hero for so long that people would like her to see her sort of taking up the cause of this horrendously oppressed minority. But actually, she's now become a political leader, and perhaps she just doesn't see it as her priority for now. So
it certainly seemed clear that, you know, she couldn't really kind of stand up against the Buddhist monks who have great power, who were very keen for this, this poor minority.
It's a clear example of those compromises.
Rafaela, when you look at the results here and what's happening and her rise back into power, are you hopeful that she can make the changes as she wants to?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, this is a country which has huge potential opportunity. It's a large population. It's got large natural resources. It's well connected. It's got lots of potential to it.
And strategically quite important as well.
Exactly. It's got interesting pipeline routes to go through it. It's got some great ports, which could be very important sort of region. So it has lots of sort of pluses going for it. And, you know, you'd hope that it could have a leadership which could actually shift it into the modern age. I think the one thing that appears to be the case around her is, and maybe it's what Samira is saying, it's this issue of, you know, of a kind of leader being a former freedom fighter who was under house arrest for so long, coming into power and still trying to work out how those levers of power actually work. Is that it has been a while now since she's sort of been in some sort of power. And I think that there has been a lot of hope that's kind of been placed on her. And there is a question of how much she's actually going to be able to affect the sort of changes that people think are necessary in that country. I mean, I try to be optimistic about things. And I think that hopefully with time this will develop, because as I say, the country has so much potential. But I think there has been a question about how long this is sort of taking to see some of the changes that people were hoping for.
And I wonder if there's a bit of suspicion that, you know, that in a way that, you know, the regime allowed for change to happen because they knew they would benefit in real cash terms from it, because, you know, many of the families who are connected to the military, they're big owners of property, and right. And that they will be the ones who will be kind of gaining from the hotel companies in and the tourism exactly. coming in. So it's an interesting story to follow. But we're going to take a short break now. You listen to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Samira Shackle and Raffaello Pantucci. Coming up next, the US expands the focus of its attack against the so-called Islamic State. And how did a Ponzi scheme in China reach $59 billion worth of strife?
How much information can you pack into a minute? Every morning, the Monocle Minute wings its way into your inbox, packed with the very latest news and views from around the world, all delivered with a Monocle twist. We'll tell you what that new aircraft carrier means for Southeast Asia, why the next EU summit will be more interesting than normal, and what to look out for at an upcoming election. We'll pick out the latest retail trend in Latin America, analyse the aviation news in Australia, and take a tour of a neighbourhood that's on the up. And there's more. At the weekend, we'll review the best new restaurants, give you the lowdown on that art exhibition you've been meaning to visit, and dissect the best of the latest fashion week. See? There's rather a lot you can pack into a minute. Sign up now at monocle.com/minute.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Samira Shackle and Raffaello Pantucci. Now, the past 3 weeks have seen the US taking a slightly different approach to its assault on the so-called Islamic State. While much of the international focus has been limited to Syria, militants aligned to the group have recently been targeted by US forces in Afghanistan. It was only last month that US President Barack Obama expanded the authority of US commanders to launch attacks within Afghan borders. The military says they've been hitting the group heavily and is making a difference. But the expanded focus certainly marks a revamped strategy. Raffael, we'll start with you. It's interesting to see this unfolding, and it feels at times a very uncoordinated kind of lineup of people attacking Islamic State. I mean, you know, we know the Russians are partly attacking them in Syria. We have, you know, is Turkey kind of stopping them finally on the borders? Mm. But anyway, the Americans seem to be expanding where they're hitting this group, moving into Afghanistan. Is this significant?
I mean, I think you have to take each context within its local sort of parameters. In other words, what the Russians are doing in Syria is sort of one thing, but I think what's happening in Afghanistan is something quite different. I think the first question is, what exactly is the Islamic State in Afghanistan? And at the moment, it's not entirely clear how much we're seeing something which is directly connected to the core in sort of Syria and Iraq, or how much we're seeing people sort of on the ground in parts of Afghanistan that have always been sort of pro-Taliban, but actually had issues with the kind of leadership in Nangarhar and Kunar, like deciding to express their disaffection in some ways from the sort of Taliban central leadership by saying, you know, I am actually Islamic State. And this sort of meaning that the group is able to sort of take advantage of that, sort of develop a bit there, and, you know, start to appear to spread its wings into this country. But how much that's actually controlled by the center is not very clear. I think in some ways the American decision of what they're doing in particular Afghanistan is a recognition of the fact that what we're seeing in terms of Islamic State on the ground in Afghanistan is something that is potentially quite worrying and potentially going to only further destabilize a government that I think the assessment is fairly potentially unstable at the moment already. And so trying to hit it as well as the sort of Taliban groups that they're already sort of attacking, or Al-Qaeda, is clearly something which is increasingly a priority.
Because we should just explain that, you know, it's clear that, you know, it's not just if you're opposed to the central government, you're all lion and friends. You know,
no.
Many Taliban are very opposed to any kind of move by Islamic State into Afghanistan.
Well, exactly. I mean, a lot of the fighting you're seeing is actually between some of these Islamic State-aligned groups and sort of Taliban groups. I mean, the sort of Taliban fragmentation has been the big story. Well, actually, fragmentation in Afghanistan in general has been the big story of the past year or more. When I think it was about June last year or May, they sort of revealed that Mullah Omar had actually died 2 years before, which sort of completely sabotaged some peace talks that were going on at that moment. What you saw was you saw a lot of this fragmentation really come up to light. Before, Mullah Omar was seen as a very unifying figure. And so all the people who broadly described themselves as Taliban, as anti-state, were kind of willing to group under him. When he was sort of removed, you had a power struggle straight afterwards, and you saw this fragmentation really start to express itself. And part of it is expressing itself in some people saying, I'm not with the Taliban, I'm with Islamic State. I'm also against the government, but I'm also against the Taliban.
Now, Samira, in all of the other arenas where we see this fight against Islamic State, it's fine, you can have these bombing raids, and we know that there are probably special forces on the ground, but in the end, you do need to have an ally on the ground who can go in and do the hard work if you don't want to do it yourself. So, you know, we're seeing in Iraq that the US forces there are working, you know, in alliance with the Iraqi army. In Syria, the Russians are working in alliance with the Assad regime. But who could the Americans really work with in some of these really kind of faraway places from Kabul and from the key kind of centres of control in Afghanistan? Because it's great, you know, in some sense, to bomb your enemy. But then what happens if you are just clearing the ground for the Taliban in a way?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been one of the consistent problems in Afghanistan, really, that there's this, I mean, one of the justifications given for the sort of expanding US operations against ISIS, not just against Taliban targets, was the sort of weakness of the Afghan security forces. And now these are security forces that America's supposedly been sort of, you know, she has been training up and so on for years and years. But I think that Afghanistan is a weak state. As Raf said, it's very fragmented. It's been ravaged by war. There's all sorts of divisions and fragmentations within society, not just within the militant landscape. So it's a really, really sort of difficult question about who those allies on the ground would be.
Rafaela?
I mean, this point about the Afghan force is a really interesting one. So I was talking to some friends who look at sort of Afghanistan in a lot of detail, and they were saying that there's an interesting correlation that they think they've noticed between when the West decides that it's going to be offering forces and providing support for the ANSF and their capacity actually going down. And when instead the West sort of stops providing a lot of this support and boots on the ground, the Afghans have to sort of figure it out. And so suddenly you see ANSF, Afghan National Forces security actually increasing. But that's a very difficult kind of balance to strike, because if you sort of decide, okay, fine, well, if we just let them to it, they'll actually get around to sorting these problems out and they'll sort of build their capacity up again. Well, what if that doesn't work and the whole thing sort of collapses under you? But there is this interesting correlation that I think people have observed between sort of removing some of the sort of support that the external forces provide and kind of letting the Afghans take the lead on it, and their capability actually improving.
That's really interesting, actually, because I guess the sort of counter-argument about what would happen if you left them would be what had happened in Iraq when ISIS was able to sweep across the country with so little problems. But I think, I mean, you can really see the logic about why capacity would go up when their hands aren't being held, I suppose. It's interesting.
Well, it certainly comes at a time when the US has said it's got 9,800 combat troops in Afghanistan at the moment, but that figure is set to fall to 5,500 by the time Obama leaves office next January. And finally tonight, if there were an international competition for the world's largest Ponzi scheme, 30-year-old Mr. Ding Ning would certainly make the finals. Despite spending his days as a salesman at his father's hardware store and having no finance or banking experience, Mr. Ding somehow managed to snatch 50 billion yuan from over 900,000 investors across China in just a year and a half. Ding Ning was arrested after police started investigating the clearly unsustainable financial scheme, but it has served as a clear reminder that in the world of online investment products, it's often near impossible to tell the decent from the dirty. Rafaela, you know a little bit about this scheme. You've been watching it from afar. Just tell us how it worked.
Well, I mean, in essence, it was a peer-to-peer on- peer-to-peer online financing kind of tool, whereby people within China could, you know, lend money to this system, and then this money would be lent to others, and then this would, you know, they would get fantastic returns on it. But I mean, from the organizer's perspective, this is great because people are sort of giving them money, and as long as they've got money cycling through the system, they continue to sort of pay out. But in the meantime, they were sort of siphoning huge amounts of money off. I mean, the extraordinary thing is, if you think about the amounts of money that are involved here, 50 billion yuan, which I think is somewhere in the region of almost, you know, 5 billion pounds or something ridiculous like that, which is a huge amount of money to sort of cycle through so quickly. I think the other extraordinary thing is this company had actually really become something of a, you know, a minor household name in China. A lot of people knew it, and
advertising on state television.
It's extraordinary. I mean, you know, the sort of depth and size of the whole scandal was extraordinary. I like one of the sort of anecdotes. I mean, you know, as with everything in China, it's sort of disproportionately large. I mean, 50 billion renminbi, was that apparently to conceal the evidence of all their sort of malfeasance, the executives put more than 1,200 account books into 80 plastic bags and buried them under 6 meters of ground in their Anhui province. So the authorities had to go there with sort of diggers to dig this up and take 20 hours using two excavators, which, you know, is a sort of fantastic snapshot of the real scale that you're kind of talking about here.
There were some remarkable pictures put up actually online of the bags of cash that he had managed to gain. You know, we shouldn't kind of look at this scheme and think, you know, oh, that's something peculiar to China. It's amazing, Samira, how these confidence trick schemes take off in parts of the world, here in Europe, in the US, all sorts of places. Ponzi schemes, there's something about them that draws in even people who are actually quite astute about their money.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the sort of poor regulation or a sort of slowness to update existing regulation in relation to the online world sort of really facilitates that intrinsic appeal that Ponzi schemes seem to have, and it sort of creates an arena where those schemes can really sort of take root and be on slightly new grounds and so on, and I think there's a tendency to believe that things really can be too good to be true on the internet. But
it's interesting for the China finance story. It comes at a time when lots of people have been losing money on the stock exchange, and now this as well. If you were a kind of ordinary investor, and this scheme allowed people to put in just like one yuan, you could invest at any level. What's interesting is, you know, I guess it's that migration from your communist state to a kind of capitalist communist state. All these people are trying their luck at trying to entering the market, trying to learn how the market works. And here's two examples in the past few months where you get horribly burnt.
I think that's it's a very good comparative between the two of them, because really, essentially, they're both gambling schemes. You know, it's essentially a giant gambling pool. The Chinese stock exchanges aren't really stock exchanges in the same sort of useful sense that we think of them in the West, as, you know, a company needs financing, you go to the stock exchange. Chinese companies can get financing very easily from sort of state banks or from sort of local banks, even not even sort of big national ones. There's sort of lots of liquidity out in China that you can use. There's no real need for you to actually go to a stock exchange to sort of do what Western companies do, which is go there and actually invest money. Instead, the sort of stock exchanges in China are really big gambling pools. You know, it's just lots of people sort of gambling and lots of middle class people gambling and playing around. And in some ways, that's what this is as well. And I think that's kind of the big sort of takeaway I would take away from these two particular stories, is that, you know, the appetite in China for gambling is huge. And so, you know, Steve Wynn should look to build a few big casinos. And actually Donald Trump as well.
The appetite for gambling, Samira. But also, the interesting thing is, all of these markets, whether it's, you know, a Ponzi scheme or the stock exchange, in the end, they can only survive and thrive if there's confidence. And what we see happening in China in all sorts of small ways is just kind of like the wind being knocked out of people. People feeling unsure what they should do with their money. And when that happens, that's when you begin to push an economy down, because, you know, we've seen it here in the West after the 2008 with the collapse of the financial markets. It wasn't that people had run out of money. On the whole, it was just that people felt they were too nervous to go back into the market. On the confidence level, do you think this is a kind of worrying moment for China?
I think the fact that the company was such a household name and that it's on such a big scale. I mean, obviously, as Raffaello said, things in China are on a big scale just by virtue of the population size. But the fact that this was a company that a huge amount had been invested, both money and time, in making it into a household name, in sort of ads on state TV that gave it the semblance of a sort of official stamp, and you know, sort of really, really pushing it. I think that does have the capacity to undermine confidence, I think, particularly for people who it was maybe their first foray into the market.
Well, we're going to have to leave our investing and gambling tips there. Samira Shackle and Raffaella Pantucci, thank you very much for joining us today on Midori House, because that's all we have time for. Today's show was produced by Ben Ryland. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and also by Ida Mae Griffiths. And our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. For the next half hour, Carlotta Rovello will be keeping you company with Monocle's international playlist. And 1900 hours is the culture show with Mr. Robert Bound. And at 2200 hours, it's time for the Monocle Daily. Well, this show, it will be back at the same time tomorrow, which is, of course, 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye from me, Andrew Tuck, and thank you very much for listening.